This is Wade's World, where we talk to the most interesting people in the world on KABF 88.3, the voice of the people.
You want to see how the other half lives? You want to see how we get around? Why don't you come visit me on the east side of town?
Wade Refke, and it's Wade's World. It's Friday, 9 a.m. Central Standard Time, and your time for Wade's World. We're broadcast in Greenville, WDSV, Little Rock, KBF, New Orleans, WAMF, and acornradio.org. The podcast of this show will be available on Monday. You destroy Wade's World. We talk for people in the world, and today we're talking to Andrew Yang, a little bit of everything. Expert, entrepreneur, author of a new book called The War on Normal People, The Truth About America's Disappearing Jobs and Why Universal Basic Income is Our Future. And get this, Ken, Democratic side. Welcome to Wade's World, Andrew.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here, guys.
Well, we're glad to have you. So first, let's talk about your book, War on Normal People. What world is universal basic income? What can we do to get that? Sounds good.
Universal basic income is a government policy where every citizen gets a certain amount of money every month to meet basic needs. It doesn't matter what you're making, whether you're working or not, just everyone gets it for being alive and an American. And under my plan, the Freedom Dividend, that amount of money would be $1,000 a month. So every American adult between 18 and 64 would receive $1,000 a month starting in 2021 when I become president.
And how would we afford that? Sounds good.
Yeah, so the great thing is it's actually much more affordable than you might imagine. Our economy has grown to $19 trillion, up $4 trillion in the last 10 years alone. And we're already spending 25 to 30% of the amount of money that it would cost to implement a universal basic income of $1,000 a month on existing programs. So the big way that we need to grow into this, and this is one of the best things about basic income, where if you imagine, Wade, if you and everyone in your community had $1,000 a month, our economy would grow immediately. And the Roosevelt Institute pegs that growth at $2.5 trillion or 13%, and the potential job creation at 4.5 million new jobs, because if we all had more money to spend, then stores would be busier, restaurants would be more full, tutors would have more business, et cetera, et cetera. So we end up getting a lot of it back in economic growth. And then the third way we need to pay for it is that we need to start taxing some of the big tech companies like Amazon and Google that right now are sucking up tons of value in retail and other parts of the economy, because right now those companies don't pay meaningful taxes relative to their size.
Well, and they're getting in trouble in a lot of European countries for some of their tax deals as well. Will this new tax bill last year help us or hurt us in putting more money towards what we could use for these kinds of programs?
Well, the big tax cut from last year, unfortunately, all it did is it blew a bigger hole in the federal budget moving forward. And according to the numbers, only 6% of that tax cut actually found its way to workers, and more than half of it went just directly to company shareholders. And if you look at the numbers, the top 20% of Americans own 92% of the stock market. So if you look at it, the gains from the tax cut essentially went to the top 20% of Americans, and that's not a good way to grow the economy. We've already found that giving rich people, and I know rich people, if you give them more money, it doesn't really do much for the economy. It just ends up like in an account somewhere. Whereas if you give money to most Americans, because right now 59% of Americans cannot pay an unexpected $500 bill, and people are living paycheck to paycheck and month to month. If you put $1,000 in the hands of an average American, then that will grow the economy much more than plowing money to corporate shareholders again.
This sounds like a radical proposal. There's a history annual income kinds of problems. And I know your book, but I started out my career as an organizer with welfare rights. I'll never forget campaign for 5,500 or fight back then, which was like a Piper's compared to 1,000 but would have changed the entire welfare for families. And you cited examples. Alaska is one, right?
Yeah, and in the U.S., you might remember this, but basic income passed the House of Representatives in 1971 and almost became law under Richard Nixon. Martin Luther King was for it. Nixon was for it. 1,000 economists signed a letter saying that it would be great for the economy, and it stalled in the Senate because Democrats wanted a higher income threshold. So this is not as extreme or radical as anyone thinks. This was mainstream political wisdom not that long ago. And as you suggested, it's been in effect in Alaska for 36 years under a Republican governor, and it's wildly popular. Everyone in Alaska gets between $1,000 and $2,000 a year to do whatever they want with it, and it's created thousands of jobs there and reduced income inequality. So this is not something that's out of the realm of possibility at all. We just need to remember what we brought to the table back in the 60s and 70s.
Well, and the proposal in the Nixon era was now former Senator Monahan, a conservative proposal, a way supposedly a lot of people don't realize, but obviously you do, a lot of our safety net is in things that don't go to lower income people, things like, you know, real estate homestead exemptions take probably the largest chunk. And you must be proposing this would be piled into another stack.
Well, you know, the great thing about it is that universal basic income doesn't grow government in that way, where the dollars go directly to you, your friends, your neighbors, your family members. And that's where it belongs. Like, we are the owners and stakeholders of this society. We can vote ourselves a dividend. The problem right now is that when money goes to government, the reason we're all upset about it is that it disappears into some set of pipe somewhere. And they say, like, oh, we did great stuff with it, but none of us really knows. Whereas if the money goes directly in our hands, we can decide what to do with it. And so, as you said, this is not like a left or right thing where people on both sides of the aisle can get excited about putting more money in the hands of the American people.
This has become, from what I read, and you would know, so I'm going to ask you the question, but you hear that UBI, Universal Basic Income, becoming a common thing to talk about sort of in the Silicon Valley because of the way jobs are likely to change in the view of a lot of tech people. You see a lot of support in that area. Some of that's not good news. It says that a lot of the jobs are going to be robots and this, that, and the other. What do you see coming?
Well, that's exactly what people in Silicon Valley see coming, and I see it coming too. And a lot of this is in my book, The War on Normal People. That's what the war on normal people is that we're going to make trucks that drive themselves. We're going to have software that does the job of call center workers. 30% of malls are going to close in the next 4 years, and 10% of Americans work in retail establishments. So to return to truckers for a minute, being a truck driver is the most common job in 29 states. There are 3.5 million truck drivers in the U.S., 94% male, average age 49. And then another 5 million people who work in truck stops and motels and diners that serve truck drivers. So if the trucks start driving themselves across the country, that's going to be devastating to many parts of the country. And that's what the people in Silicon Valley are working on right now. So that's why they and I am so excited about implementing something like a universal basic income as fast as possible, because we're quickly entering a period where things that you would have thought of as science fiction are becoming real.
How many years do you think we have, Andrew?
Well, they tell me right now they're 98% of the way there, and they're working on the last 2%. So the tech is going to be ready, in my opinion, in the next 5 to 10 years. And then the question is whether government regulations follow suit. But they're getting increasingly confident in Silicon Valley. And anyone listening to this thinking it's far out, I mean, let me tell you that there's a pot of gold worth $168 billion for companies to try and get this right. And so they have some of the smartest people in the country working on it every day, and they will get it right. Do not bet against them and nearly unlimited resources.
It's hard to it's hard to put a finger in that dike. We're talking to Andrew Yang, who's written a book about universal basic income and other things called The War on Normal People. Andrew, you somehow believe that a way to deal with some of these questions is political, right?
Well, you have to look at it. You have to look at a big picture where, again, this was on the table in the 60s and 70s. And if the government is not involved, it's hard to see who's going to make any significant change, even as robots and artificial intelligence technology start sweeping through the economy, because it's not in private companies' interest. And I'm a serial entrepreneur. I love business. I love business people. I love starting businesses. But there's no business that has like a huge profit motive behind employing thousands of people that used to work at the mall. Or, you know, it's like if you look at it realistically, another $40 billion in retail goes to Amazon every year. So Main Street businesses are closing right and left. So we have to start acknowledging what's happening. We're going through the greatest economic and technological transformation in human history. And there's no entity aside from the government, unfortunately. And I don't love it because the government is not great at a lot of things. But one thing the government can get right is the government can take some of the incredible gains that technology is generating in our economy and return it to us, the owners and shareholders of this country. And that's something I'm going to make happen as president. But if you look at it rational, like you look at it clearly, who else is going to do something about these changes? Like it or not, we're left with the government.
Well, there's no question. It has a role, but it's so different than the way the government sees its role right now that it's going to be to convince people once again that government is going to be the friend of everyday people, isn't it?
Well, and that is a challenge. We have to take ownership of our government again. This is a democracy. There's nothing stopping us from voting ourselves a dividend. And right now, the government in D.C. certainly has been taken over by corporate interests and big money interests. And that's what we need to change. I mean, we have to start distributing the value that's generated here in this country to us, to the citizens, as opposed to having it held captive by a handful of companies and people.
It's a big decision to run for president, though. I mean, this is your first, this is a question, I guess. Is this your first political venture?
Well, I was appointed to a couple of things in D.C. over the last number of years, but it's my first elected run. I will say, though, that I started a nonprofit that created thousands of jobs over the last number of years, and the activities of starting a nonprofit and running for office are quite similar, it turns out.
Well, having worked at a lot of nonprofits, I understand that there's a lot of politics involved. So, yeah, I could vote on that with you, Andrew.
So yeah, it sounds like you know it.
Well, Acorn was, you know, was one of those kinds of large nonprofit organizations. So it's early to declare president. So what's it like? What are you doing? How are you getting the word out? Are you getting a good response, or what's the plan?
We're getting a tremendous response. We have new supporters every day, and it's incredibly invigorating. We get students and homemakers and nurses and engineers and truck drivers and retail associates donating to my campaign every day on my website, yang2020.com. And it's incredibly touching because I haven't met most any of these people, and they see that I'm trying to do right by them. They also can easily imagine what they and their families would do with an extra $1,000 a month. I mean, if you have three people in your household that are between the ages of 18 and 64, that'll be $3,000 a month to pay your bills, repair your car, make a, you know, maybe even start saving a little bit for your kids' educational needs or the future. And that's what we need to do. So I get new supporters every day, I'm very grateful to say. The campaign's growing. The Las Vegas bookmakers just put my odds of becoming president at 200-1, and it's just going to grow from there.
Well, it's, at least you got on the list, because there's already a crowded field of wannabes and maybe bees. How do you break into that sort of gaggle of folks?
Well, what I've found so far, Wade, is that the truth is a very powerful thing, and I'm the only political figure who's willing to tell the truth about what's happening in our economy, that we automated away 4 million manufacturing jobs. We're about to do the same thing to millions of retail jobs and transportation jobs, and that we need to make big changes to our economy to start serving us again, to start serving the citizens of this country. And so because of the truth of that message, the word spreads every day where people are telling their friends and family and say, hey, this seems too good to be true, but there's nothing stopping us from doing it if we just decide to get together. So other politicians I've seen, many of them are good people, but I have to say they're unwilling to talk very frankly about the issues that face the American people.
Well, we know that from the White House down. There have been some, since universal basic income is so much a platform you're running on, there have been experiments, particularly in European countries, around UBI. Some of them have gone, well, some of them are in progress. Some of them have already been shut down. How do you evaluate what people's response has been over there?
Well, when I wrote my book, I looked at every single basic income trial that has happened over the last number of years in any part of the world. And the data around basic income trials is so positive, and it makes sense where people's nutrition gets better, their mental health improves, graduation rates go up, domestic violence goes down, hospital visits go down. Children's personalities even change to become more conscientious and agreeable, which are very positive attributes for doing well in life.
If we could get that to adults, too, that would be good.
Yes, you know it. I mean, I know it, too.
Go ahead. I'm sorry to interrupt.
No, not at all. So there have been some studies around the world, but the studies recently have been not really basic income, honestly, because basic income is where everyone in a community gets a certain amount of money. The trials recently have been giving groups of unemployed people $600 a month and then see what they do. I mean, that's not really a basic income trial. You know, what's interesting is that back in the 60s and 70s when the U.S. was looking at rolling this out, the United States government did large-scale trials in Denver and New Jersey and other parts of the country. If you can imagine a government that had its act together enough to give people cash and at scale and see what's what the positive outcomes are. And that's what I'm going to do as president, where we're going to roll this out to people quickly because the American people are suffering and we're decades behind.
One of the lessons I learned in that period that I never lost, even though I was, a young baby organizer, 2021, when we didn't agree to the final numbers, which were more like $2,500 a year, the Nixon administration was approving and held out for more, we might should have made the deal. But those things change. And one of the things that's in the European experience, a lot of it has been a much lower figure than you're talking about, $1,000 a month. Do you think that has a factor?
Yeah, some of the trials have been for lower amounts. Sometimes they've actually asked for more, where in Switzerland a referendum was asking for $36,000 a year, which, strikes me as a bit too high. So $1,000 a month is a great amount because it's enough to make a real difference in the lives of families and individuals. But it's not enough to thrive or prosper, and it's certainly not enough to replace a job where it's going to give you a boost. It's going to help you switch opportunities and maybe move, maybe go back to school, maybe start your own business. But it's not going to be enough where everyone can, drink wine and eat cheese or do whatever.
No question about that.
Hmm?
No question. You're right. It's not going to be a cheese-eating, wine-tasting affair.
No. It's like enough to take the edge off and give you the freedom to at least, if you're in a tough situation, to be able to plan your next move. If you have an exploitative or abusive job, then you don't have to necessarily just, take it and lump it. So it's going to help people a great deal, and it's something that we can eminently afford and we should do immediately.
One of the ironies, we're talking to Andrew Yang, who's running for president, but is also running on a platform that includes a universal basic income and has written a book, The War on Normal People, we'll keep talking about. You know, when you talk about $12,000 a year, that's not so far than what the federal minimum wage is. That's, which is what, $15.5 or so at, if you're working full time. So you're really talking about, for many families in the country, almost doubling what their income might be.
Well, it maps out to about $6 an hour if you were to be working full-time-ish. The poverty level in the United States is $12,770 a year, so it's still below the poverty line. But it would be a massive boost. Like, if you were a server making $18,000 a year right now, you'd be getting $30,000, and that's enormous. And that would play out throughout the economy.
That would be amazing. So what you're proposing somewhat confronts this notion that other tech people are arguing about the future of a gig economy, doesn't it?
Yeah, the gig economy, if you look at it, 94% of the jobs created between 2005 and 2015 were temp contractor or gig economy jobs that did not have health care benefits or other benefits. And the people in technology see that too. They see that the relationship between an employer and employee has completely changed and broken down in ways that are good for the bottom line but bad for workers, and most of us are workers. So that's something. Now, there's some mythology around it that, like, be your own boss, be an entrepreneur, like, have flexible work hours, and some of that stuff is true, but the reality is that if you're trying to start a family, healthcare matters a lot more to you than than other things. So so the nature of work is changing, but our institutions aren't catching up.
Not at all. And the other issue is obviously what happens if someone, let's say, makes a career in the gig economy. What happens when they get to Social Security age and don't have any benefits paid? I mean, that would almost say UBI is something ahead of its time because, I mean, if we're talking about millions of workers going that direction, we're going to have quite an issue 20, 30 years from now, aren't we, Andrew?
Oh, yeah. I mean, Social Security is scheduled to go bankrupt in 27 years, I believe. And very, very few Americans who are my parents' age have enough saved for retirement. And it's one of the things that's driving an increase in insecurity in this country is that people are hanging on to jobs because they don't have a choice because they don't have the savings to retire in any meaningful way. And universal basic income would help a great deal with that, too, where if you're 55 years old and Social Security is 10 years away, getting $1,000 a month immediately would be a great bridge. You know, it could be that you're over 65, but you have other people who are 45 in your household, and them getting $1,000 a month would be immensely helpful. So this would help people in just about every situation and age and stage. And we can totally afford it. This isn't like a grow the government thing. This is like a give the gains the economy to more people, put it in our hands, and let us do what we want with it.
Andy Stern, who is the former president of the Service Employees International Union and somebody certainly I worked with for many, many years, he also wrote a book advocating something similar in universal basic income. Have you gotten any, but he had trouble getting traction even on other labor unions. Have you had good experience talking to unions about this, or what is their reaction, people who represent working people?
Well, Andy Stern is a friend and advisor of the campaign. I read his book and found it profoundly influential. So after you read my book, feel free to pick up Andy's book, Raising the Floor. Labor unions are in a tough spot where I think labor unions do a fantastic job increasing wages and benefits for workers, and the fact that labor unions have been gutted in many environments is one of the reasons why the economy has become so unfair to so many workers. But for labor unions, it's tricky to advocate for universal basic income because, in a way, it's like it's a different argument because labor unions talk about the centrality of the worker, and in many ways universal basic income is talking about the centrality of the value of just being an American or being a human being. And so it's like a different focus, But it's clear that if you're a unionized laborer, getting an extra $1,000 a month would be hugely advantageous. And so when it comes to just improving the lives of workers, many people in unions are very interested in this idea.
We've had a number of years now without even an increase in federal minimum wage. So clearly this is going to be an uphill fight. Why do you believe so many of our elected officials are resisting even on a small increase in the minimum wage when we're talking about the need for something like universal basic income?
Well, I think no one in America should be working full time and be struggling in poverty. I mean, that's just wrong. And I think that the fact that our minimum wage has not risen over the years is a sign of just how captured our government and society have become by corporate interests who irrationally, in my view, are arguing against a minimum wage. I will say, though, that if you were to raise the minimum wage too much, it would speed up the automation of many jobs, where if you look at fast food jobs, as an example, they pay only about $10 or $11 an hour, less in many circumstances.
Lucky.
Yeah, if you're lucky, it's like $9 in many places. And so if you were to raise that to $15, many fast food companies would replace workers, at least to some extent, with self-serve kiosks and some other things. So there is a balance to be had. In my mind, it's much more efficient just to give money directly to Americans. If you increase the minimum wage, I'm spiritually very much in favor of increasing the minimum wage because no one in America should be working and poor. But there is a relationship between the automation of jobs and how much you're paying people.
There's no question. If you've walked into a McDonald's any time in the last year or two, it's amazing how many of them now. And it's also amazing how difficult it is to use them. They almost always have somebody there to help use the kiosk. That could be a problem in some of this automation, couldn't it?
Yeah, it very much could, but they're not going to stop. I mean, McDonald's already announced that they're going to roll out self-serve kiosks in every location in the United States by 2020, which is only 2 years from now.
Right.
So they're going to keep doing it. They're going to try and get it right, in large part because they see the cost savings.
And Walmart is likely to go that way too, aren't they, as the world's largest, I mean, certainly the U.S.'s largest private sector employer. You can already see them trying to push more and more towards scanning, huh?
Yeah, and I'm like you, where like I struggle with the self-scanning, and I was like, oh man, I wish someone was here to help me do this. I was good at it, but you have to look at everyone's incentives as these major public corporations. They have to just try and maximize their bottom line, and for them, if they can find a way to replace workers, they almost feel like they have no choice but to do it. So what we have to do is we have to fundamentally change our economic system so that, one, we as Americans have our basic needs, like in our own hands, like we're going to have enough wealth and means to be able to make positive plans for the future. But the second thing is we have to realign our corporate incentives, because if you're a good person, a bad person, it's difficult to really make different choices if you're a slave to this earnings report that you have to report every quarter, and then Wall Street brutalizes you if you report bad numbers. So we have to give corporations the flexibility to do things that maybe aren't great for their bottom line in the short term, but maybe are good for us in some way, like in terms of employing people, retraining people, because the incentives to do those things right now are not really there.
We've got some issues. Andrew, I want you to tell people where they can get your book now in our final minute.
Well, thank you for that. My book is available. My book's The War on Normal People. It's available online if you just on Amazon or BarnesandNoble.com, bookstores everywhere. And my website, to find out more information about my presidential campaign, is yang2020.com. We have a campaign called One for Humanity, where we ask people just to donate $1 as a sign that you think that a new economy is where we have to go. And if you just Google my name, Andrew Yang, it brings you there. This is still a democracy. We can still make big changes, but we have to do it together, because the folks in Washington are not going to do it for us.
That's YANG. Andrew, thank you. It's been a fascinating interview. This has been Wade's World for another week, the world where we talk about things that, as Lucinda Williams sang, you don't see and don't hear about. We say it loud. We say it on the radio. Until next week, when we'll have another guest on Wade's World, this is Wade Rathke.
This program is produced by the Arkansas Broadcasting Foundation, KABF-FM in Little Rock, Arkansas, and is distributed through Affiliated Media Foundation Movement, AMFM, serving the needs and interests of low and moderate income Americans.